Hey, Trey here. Two things. First, I'm not sure if you know it, but Us and Them was honored with 4 Associated Press Broadcasters Awards, including one for excellence in public service through journalism. Second, it's the time for the Spring Pledge Drive at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And if you value the work that our Us and Them team does in telling the stories about the things that divide Americans, would you consider making a pledge of support to West Virginia Public Broadcasting? You can call or text to 1-800-RADIO-87, or you can go online to WV Public and find the little red button at the upper right-hand corner. And when you pledge, let them know where you live and that you're a listener of Us and Them. Doing this would be a big help for our show and the other great programming at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And thank you so much.
This episode of Us and Them is supported with a grant from the Claude Worthington Benedum Foundation.
Hey, Trey K here. And from West Virginia Public Broadcasting and PRX, this is Us and Them. We're the show that talks about the things that divide us, and sometimes the things that unite us. Since the onset of the pandemic, we've talked to people about how life is different. The coronavirus affects us all, but not all equally. Essential workers in hospitals and grocery stores know best what life is like behind a mask and gown and gloves. Childcare workers are also on the essential list. For those with kids, childcare providers make work possible. But COVID has turned the childcare business upside down with new requirements and regulations to keep kids and employees safe. Those new health and safety requirements mean increased costs at a time when there are fewer kids. Not good for the bottom line. But parents, especially those with frontline essential jobs, need a place for their children. COVID has changed things, starting at the front door. A new classification now considers childcare centers critical care sites, only kids and employees allowed. Parents do drop-off and pick-up at the curb or front door. That's just one of the moves state regulators made to keep centers open and safe. Lisa Ertl directs early care and education for the State Department of Health and Human Resources. She says they've learned a lot in an effort to keep things open. So when you are there with the people in your department and you're looking at this oncoming problem, you know, a global pandemic, and you're seeing what's happening in the state surrounding West Virginia, what was making you shake in your boots?
Worst case scenarios for us was looking at what was happening in other countries and in the United States. It was inevitable that it was going to eventually reach and affect West Virginia.
And what is at stake if childcare is impacted, if it's closed?
Childcare is a workforce foundation. Without childcare, folks can't go to work. Folks might lose their jobs. Businesses are affected. The economy is affected. Everything. There was a 2018 report done by Ready Nation that studied the economic impact of insufficient childcare. And they estimated that it was about $57 billion in earnings and tax revenues were going to be lost at the time. So if you think about that big of an impact on inadequate childcare back in 2018, and you fast forward to 2020 when this pandemic comes, then it's this perfect storm. If parents can't work and feel comfortable with sending their children to a childcare program, then it doesn't lead to a very productive workforce.
Lisa Ertl says she and her staff are helping childcare centers navigate increased requirements to stay open for business. She says access to licensed quality care was a challenge, even before the pandemic. Can the lack of reliable childcare create an us and them divide in a society?
It could. What happens is either those that have are able to pay more for quality care, or they have an easier access to that quality care. We have an awful lot of rural communities that have just a handful, if that many, just a few childcare licensed or registered childcare providers. So what happens oftentimes is somebody will pay their next door neighbor to babysit. It's not regulated, it's not licensed, there's no oversight. So we don't know the quality of care that child might be getting.
Why is it especially problematic in rural areas?
You might be living in a rural area and you don't have the number of children you need to sustain your business, for example. So it's not financially feasible for them to do that.
Safe, reliable childcare plays an essential role in creating the workforce. It gives adults a way to work and know that their children are at childcare or at school. How much has the essential nature of childcare been kind of invisible in the past?
Unless you are a parent or a guardian in need of childcare, or you are somehow involved in a child's life and understand that need for childcare, it's not something that's readily on other people's radar. It's a nice service, and folks assume that there's plenty of care available. But that's not the case. There's not plenty of child care available.
How much has this pandemic helped bring this issue into the spotlight?
It has shined a huge light on child care and the need for child care. March 24th, a memo went out that businesses were to close unless they were essential, and only child care providers that were willing to become critical child care sites to care for employees of essential children were permitted to remain open and operating. With that came a lot of requirements. So their costs have increased while they are not operating on full capacity. So it's been extremely difficult for them that way.
So if I understand this right, the reason that you want to keep this open is that childcare is essential to make the West Virginia workforce. And so the pandemic, it is going to end. And when it ends, we want to have childcare facilities that we could step back into so that people can get back into the economic workforce.
That's right. Childcare was available when things were quote unquote normal. We want to have it still available when we do finally reach that quote unquote normal again.
Had to do to keep childcare open in West Virginia?
We have conducted a couple of surveys with childcare providers to see initially what they needed, and then one that we did a couple months ago to see what they needed at, 6 months into the pandemic.
You checked in with them early on, and now you're keeping tabs or checking in.
Right. We ask questions, what would you need to reopen? What would you need to sustain your business? All of those type of things. What we have coming out very soon are some grant opportunities. Grants for sanitation supplies, because we have heard from providers. One provider told us that her budget has gone up $1,000 a month because of the extra sanitation supplies that she needs.
Well, like what? What does she need?
Wipes, masks, cleaning supplies, you know, all of those type of things that you think about when we talk about sanitation.
What were the most important steps at first to ensure that childcare could stay open?
The first steps were to make sure that currently operating family care centers continued to meet health and safety requirements. And I think that we were fortunate because childcare providers were already familiar with and already implementing a lot of the health and sanitation guidelines that eventually the Center for Disease Control put into place for child care centers.
You had basically, as you said, general standards for cleanliness, making sure that people were sanitary. But the COVID pandemic really kind of was making a very different and more stringent and specific.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. The child care providers were familiar with sanitation, what they needed to do. But working with our local health departments, we were able to make sure that those CDC guidelines with social distancing, with wearing masks, with diaper changing, all of those things that you think of when you think of childcare were being implemented appropriately. Childcare providers had to develop a system with, you know, the children checking in the morning, getting their temperatures taken, certain questions being asked to make sure that they had not been somehow exposed, all of that.
I feel like just about everybody who I've interviewed, from school teachers to physicians to healthcare workers to people who work in recovery, that this was a time where it just seemed like everybody was improvising. Were you improvising?
Truth be told, yes, we improvised. But like I said, child care providers still had that background of health and safety. They knew that they needed to sanitize. They knew that they needed to do all of those kind of things. But we didn't have all the information as this emerged in March. So we did work, like I said, very closely with the local health departments to make sure that as more information came available, we shared that with child care providers. Protocol was written on those CDC guidelines, all of that. And we made sure that child care providers were supported as they implemented those things. So we had to kind of on the fly almost develop a whole new child care system.
That new system happened fast. Just days after the coronavirus became a national health emergency, the state announced that child care centers could only stay open if they became a critical care site.
We tried to make it as simple as possible, but get the information that we needed. There's a form that's filled out, and we need to make sure on that form that anybody working in the center has had their criminal background checks, that they've been checked for adult and child protective services, that they've been checked for the sex offender registry, that the fire marshal has approved their location, that the health department has approved their location and their nutrition schedules, those type of things. So those were some of the basic things that we needed to make sure that that was met. In addition, as I said, we worked very closely with the Office of Environmental Protection, with the health departments to develop, developed a checklist of the CDC guidelines to make sure that centers and family child care homes were implementing those safety procedures related to the CDC guidelines. So all of that had to be filled out and submitted before they could become a critical care site.
The ones that are open now, are they all critical care certified?
Yes, you still have to register as a critical care site if you want to open.
You've mentioned that in the early days of the pandemic, that only 40% of the child care facilities in the state were open. What happens if you were in a region where your child care facility was not a critical site and you had no option?
That through the whole pandemic has been a very real struggle for parents. Even now we get phone calls from parents that said, you know, I have tried to find childcare in my area and I can't. But what we have found is that we need to be able to allow businesses or entities to open up what we call a pop-up site.
A pop-up site?
Yes. It's childcare that kind of just pops up. You know, it's a temporary site that still meets health and safety guidelines, still meets childcare regulatory guidelines, but they were able to be opened very quickly to help meet that need when those other childcare providers were closed.
As I'm thinking about these pop-up sites, it almost to me, I think back of, you know, the World War II effort where, you know, people were making victory gardens and saving their metal and all that stuff. It seems like in many ways, maybe that's the way some people are seeing it, is that this is a way to kind of help us all get through this.
Exactly. Exactly. And what has been the good thing about these family childcare folks becoming pop-up sites, they're finding that they love it. So they are inquiring about how to do it permanently. So we're able to get them registered to become permanent providers as well. So when the pandemic's over, their pop-up site won't go away. They will be able to do it full time. So, which is awesome.
Lisa Ertl says now nearly 85% of the state's child care centers are open as critical care sites. That's up from 40% just a few months ago. Coming up after a break, I wonder what this all looks like from the other side. How are directors of child care centers staying afloat with all these new restrictions? And what about parents? Are they re-enrolling their kids? You're listening to Us and Them. This program is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council and the CRC Foundation. This episode is supported with a grant from the Claude Worthington Benedum Foundation.
In difficult times, music gives us peace, brings us together, and helps heal us. It calms our nerves and brightens our days. That's why we're bringing you classic episodes of Mountain Stage on air and in our podcast. This is Larry Gross, host of Mountain Stage. Find something that's familiar or brand new and feel the power of live music on our website, mountainstage.org.
Hey, Trey here, and you're listening to Us and Them from PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Talking with Lisa Ertl, who directs early care and education for West Virginia, gives me a sense of the guidelines they've created to help child care centers open back up. But I was curious, how is it actually working? To help me answer that question, my colleague, Kyle Vass, visited the Children's Place in Huntington, West Virginia. It's functioning as a critical care site.
Children's Place is a one-story octagon of a building with brick walls and a brown tin roof. It looks more like a church or a visitor center from the 70s than an actual school.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hi, I was here. Is Gretchen here? I was here to record for West Virginia Public Broadcasting. I'm with Public Radio.
Favorite radio stations. That's where my car radio is all the time.
The administrative assistant opens the door, letting me into the atrium, where bright orange walls and colored rugs welcome 75 kids every day. This child care center is home to a preschool and a kindergarten, but it's also a daycare that takes in infants from just 6 weeks old. A red line across the floor keeps me from walking past the entrance of the center, while the decor screams, "Children welcome."
It also looks a lot smaller than it used to.
Hi, Gretchen.
Hi.
It feels really weird being here.
Doesn't it feel weird?
Yeah. Have you? I mean, I'm sure you get this all the time. Like, people have come back here.
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, yeah. And they just kind of look around and go, it looked a lot bigger when I was here.
Gretchen Palmer was my kindergarten teacher when I went to school here an undisclosed number of years ago.
Gretchen Palmer. I'm the director of Children's Place.
Gretchen says managing a preschool slash daycare slash kindergarten is already stressful under normal conditions. But during COVID?
It's very stressful because you have 75 little lives on the line. Now, we have, when we take temps in the morning, I have sent kids who have like a 99. It's not really a fever, but it's questionable. Go have the doctor check them out. And they're usually really good about it because they want to keep their child safe too. And they appreciate the fact that we're checking and making sure that we're up on it. And then the doctor will look them over and they can come back if I have a note from the doctor that says it's an ear infection.
They'd probably be more frustrated if it was their own boss telling them they had to go home as opposed to their child.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and again, I haven't had a whole lot of pushback. I've had some that grumbled, but, you know, sorry. And, you know, I don't really, that's the rules. Sorry. If you don't like it, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But that is the way it's going to be. The school-age kids who go to public school a couple of days a week and then come to us for virtual learning have to change their shoes when they come in so that they're not carrying germs from public school into my building. So they keep a set here, they change their shoes, and then when they leave, they change back out and go.
Wow, down to the shoes. Is there much in terms of like trying to keep the like inevitably sticky hands of children less sticky or they just ooze the stuff?
They ooze fluids from every part of their body.
Yeah. It's always sticky, the hands.
It's always sticky, gooey. You know, we don't use hand sanitizer that's mostly for the staff and for the parents. We just wash hands constantly or use baby wipes and, you know, stuff like that. So,
is it because they might put it in their eye or?
The hand sanitizer? It's alcohol. If they lick their hands are always in their mouth and they're consuming alcohol.
Of course, before the pandemic, none of this was in place. No temperature taking, no extra pair of shoes at the door, no red line keeping outsiders from entering the building. She says at the onset, parents were worried about sending their kids to a daycare. She was faced with a mass exodus of parents.
A lot of people were panicky, and so they just decided, okay, well, my business is shutting down, so I'm just going to keep all the kids at home. And we did lose some, and it's building back up now. But we got a critical care license through the state of West Virginia, where we could only take essential workers, and so that cut down our enrollment kind of even more because you could only have daycare if you were an essential employee in somebody's business.
So did they change? I mean, I guess they said all child care centers are shut down unless you have the
unless
certificate.
You have that certificate, yes. And it was one of those things. I got the email at like 10 o'clock one night that by 7 o'clock the next morning that application had to be in or you could not open your doors at 7 o'clock.
You got this at 10 p.m.
Yes. And it was like, oh, crap. So I got to work at 5 o'clock in the morning, got my application done, and shot it to the state. I said, your doors will not open if you are not in the process of applying for this certificate. So I was in the process. I got it in at 6 o'clock.
So as like an administrator, director, manager figure, was there a lot of just having to like call your staff back and be like, okay, now this is this, now this is that?
Yes. Okay, now we have to do it this way. We did close down for the month of April just because it was getting bad. We didn't know what was going to happen. Staff was getting panicky, you know, because you're dealing with the public. And staff was getting very concerned. And I was getting concerned for them. So talking with the board, we decided that we would shut down for the month of April. And then we started back up in May. And that just kind of gave us all a chance to regroup and kind of get ourselves together personally. And then we could come back and do our job.
Gretchen says she used that month to develop policies. She knew when the school reopened, there'd be a learning curve for new protocols inside the building. But she feels the need, to this day, to keep an ear out for what her staff is up to outside the building as well.
When all of the decisions that had to be made regarding, like, telling employees, like, look, you're not going to go travel, you're not going to go to these hotspots and just come back, was there any pushback on that? I mean, were employees...
They all really understood that we are a collective unit, and we have to, as a group, we all play a part in keeping everybody safe, and my actions prevent you from getting sick. And they really stepped up, and they did a great job. So I really didn't get a lot of pushback. There were some grumbles, but I was kind of a hard nose about, no, you won't. No, you won't. Now, obviously, I can't totally control what you do on the weekend, but I'd question them. So what'd you do this weekend? And then I might cock an eyebrow if it's something that was... Give them the mom eyebrow. Now, when they found out that they would have to quarantine if they went out of state on vacation and stuff like that, they weren't happy, but they didn't push it. They canceled their plans. So I was really proud of them.
Was it the same thing with parents?
You know, they really were actually quite thankful that, you know, we were trying to protect their kids and keep everybody safe. If I've had some that cancel vacation plans because they knew that the potential of them having to quarantine and their child quarantine, it's just not worth putting anybody at risk. And they realize that, you know, okay, I could go on vacation and my kid comes here. He may be fine, but he may make somebody else sick.
Gretchen introduced me to one of those parents, Megan Shoemaker. Megan is one of those essential workers who had no idea what to do with their kids when COVID first hit.
I am a nurse practitioner for palliative care.
Megan works at a cancer center in a local hospital. She needed to be at work, but her go-to babysitters, her own parents, were not an option.
They watched all of my kids since they were babies, and they sort of just said, no way, like, we can't do it. We're on lockdown, which left my husband and I in a bit of a pickle. We totally understood, but it was still a little frustrating for us because we were like, what in the world are we going to do?
And to make matters worse.
Prior to that, the Monday, Tuesday, prior to school stopping and the world coming to a halt, I got super sick. So I found right when COVID hit that I had this huge disappointment in the healthcare system because I was the sickest I'd ever been. I had a negative flu test and I couldn't get anybody to take care of me. Nobody wanted to lay hands on me because I was so sick. And, you know, it was just hitting and it was new. So there wasn't a test. You couldn't get your hands on a COVID test. And on top of that, everybody was shutting down and scared.
Megan says being a patient at the onset of COVID changed her entire perspective on healthcare.
So they didn't want somebody who was symptomatic even walking into their office. It was horribly sad for me, and I think a lot of that was because I'm a healthcare worker. I know these people on some level. These are my coworkers, my colleagues. These are people that do what I do, and yet I can't get good care. And that was really shocking to me. I'd just never seen healthcare through those eyes before. I was in it to take care of people. And when it was me being the person, I really felt let down by the system, if I'm being honest.
As a healthcare worker, Megan was high risk for COVID. But despite her connections at the hospital, she says she still felt very alone.
I really wanted the answer of what was going on, you know, what's going on with me. I had a negative flu, and I was sick. I mean, I was very sick and it was scary. And so I think the fear of it all and not being able to really sort of convince somebody that I needed an office visit, you know, I needed to be seen, was traumatic in its own way for me because it really shook it shook up my view of what the healthcare system was really all about.
COVID testing wasn't widely available at the time, so she got antibiotics and was turned away from visiting her own hospital. Her three kids were all under the age of six, and her husband, who's an accountant, was busy working from home, in and out of Zoom calls all day.
Nobody would come near me or my kids, especially my parents. Those were some dark times where we were really ready to wave the white flag in parenting. We needed rescued for sure.
After she recovered, Megan's workload was cut to 20 hours a week. She says that helped her have more time to take care of her kids. She says she and her husband made it through the summer, and as fall grew closer, their school district offered two options: completely virtual learning from home or a hybrid model with 2 days at school and 2 days at home. Megan wanted her kids to go virtual. Daycares were opening back up to kids of essential workers, and the state offered a program called Links to subsidize their childcare costs.
We actually chose all virtual because at the time we had a Link certificate for being essential workers. Link was covering our childcare.
But on the first week of school, the state announced it only had a few months of funding left for the subsidy program. So Megan and her family had to scramble to figure out things on their own.
Then Link withdrew our certificate briefly and said they were out of money. And so at that time, we really had to, you know, drop back and reevaluate some things. And what we decided to do was switch to the blended program.
Megan's kids would go to school in person for 2 days a week, do 2 days virtually at home, and have 1 day off. But Megan says to this day, she has no idea if switching to the blended program was the right call. And for her, that's the toughest thing about being a parent during this pandemic.
No decision feels like a good decision. And I think that's one of the most exhausting parts of parenting right now is just you can make a decision, but it doesn't feel, there isn't a decision where you're like, yes, this is the right decision for us and it feels good and I'm doing the right thing for me and for my kids and for my community. I don't know that anybody can say right now like that they really can sit with the decision they've made and feel good about it. I think there's just too many factors at play. We just have to do the best we can do.
I really empathize with where Megan is coming from. Everyone seems like they're constantly needing to improvise and figure out a workaround. Megan's family has had to make choices and land on one that feels less terrible than the alternatives. When childcare options are in jeopardy, parents juggle just to get through the day. When the pandemic started, we all had to scramble to figure out the best way to survive. We cleared out stores, stocking up on food. We bought cleaning supplies in bulk. The us and them divides across America are showing. We differ on which experts to trust. We have a range of approaches to keep ourselves safe. But despite those differences, we all need to make these tough decisions. Choices that we aren't certain about. The kind that, at best, often lead to more questions than answers. You've been listening to Us and Them. Our team for this episode is me, Trey Kay, Kyle Vass, and Kate Smith. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow wrote and performed the Us and Them show music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. Lelena Price provides us with images for the web. The marvelous people at PRX and West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the West Virginia Humanities Council, and the CRC Foundation. This episode is supported with a grant from the Claude Worthington Benedum Foundation. Us and Them was originally developed with assistance from the mentorship program at AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio. We'll see you next time on Us and Them.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.